this season on DNA ID, a couple shot at a campground, a realtor waylaid at a home showing, a bookstore owner stabbed among her volumes, a young soldier dumped in a parking lot. What do all these tragic cases have in common? They are all cold cases solved after decades of frustration and futility by forensic genealogy. I'm Jess Betancourt, and in season two of DNA ID, I'll bring you 24 more fascinating cases in which the killer eluded generations of investigators until science and some crafty genealogists cracked them at long last. Listen to DNA ID on your favorite podcast platform. New episodes drop every other Monday.
We had discussed how it happened, where we get the weapons at. Mr. Garnett asked me if I could help him with it because he needed somebody to drive for him.
It was shortly after lunchtime at Westside Middle School in Jonesboro, Arkansas, on the 24th of March 1998. When the fire alarm began blaring in the classrooms. Children shuffled out into the schoolyard. It was a welcome relief from the morning's mundane classes. As children stood around chatting, a pop echoed in the schoolyard, followed by another, and then another, and then another. In 1998, Jonesboro was a university town of around 52,000 residents, located on Crowley's Ridge in Arkansas. It's around 130 miles northeast of Little Rock. It has a slogan, People, Pride, Progress, and has quite historic significance, having 12 sites listed on the National Register of Historic Places. People are drawn to the area by the good schools, one of which is Westside Middle School. The 24th of March 1998 started out like a regular day for students at Westside Middle School, with the morning being an uneventful one. At around 12:30 p.m., the fire alarm inside the school began to ring. 11-year-old Whitney Irving had been in her 6th grade classroom, and she was excited when she heard the fire alarm. It was a pleasant spring afternoon, and the fire drill was a welcome break from the mundane weekday. All of the students were ushered outside into the schoolyard. Whitney was walking hand in hand with her best friend, 11-year-old Brittany Varner. As friends chatted amongst themselves, a large pop echoed in the air, followed by another and then another. Whitney turned to her friend Brittany and asked, "What's that noise?" She replied, "I don't know." Whitney then said that it sounded like a car backfiring. Excitement quivered in the air, as some children thought that they had been taken outside to watch an impromptu play from the drama students. They began clapping, unsure of what exactly they were witnessing. A couple of children thought that the noises were simply construction noises, as there was construction work being carried out nearby the school. Within seconds, however, confusion quickly turned to panic when Principal Karen Kirtner screamed at the children to get inside the gym. Amid the chaos, children were screaming and running to get inside the nearby gym. The loud popping sound continued, and with each pop the students heard, their fear escalated as students around them began to fall to the floor. Whitney and her best friend, Brittany, ran towards the gym. While running, they heard somebody scream, "Oh my God, she's dead." Whitney then felt a sharp pain in her back, followed by numbness. When she tried to stand up, she crumpled back to the ground. Whitney had been shot once in the back. She looked behind her to see Brittany on the floor close behind. She was surrounded in a puddle of blood. "Whitney! Whitney!" Brittany sobbed, before falling silent. Whitney begged Brittany to get up, but Brittany was motionless on the floor. Whitney managed to get up off the floor and she rushed to her best friend's side. She grabbed her by the arms and attempted to drag her to safety with the assistance of teacher Debbie Spencer. Whitney managed to make it into the gym. She glanced around, expecting somehow to see her best friend Brittany there. Brittany, however, wasn't there. Brittany had been shot dead. The same bullet that killed her then entered Whitney's back. As Whitney lay down in the gym, with blood seeping from her back, 32-year-old English teacher Shannon Wright was attempting to protect the children outside as they dove for cover and ran towards the gym. As another pepper spray of gunfire echoed in the air, Shannon threw herself in front of sixth grader Emma Pittman. Shannon fell to the ground, having been shot in the chest and abdomen. But in that split second, Emma was able to get cover. As Shannon lay on the ground, bleeding from the two gunshot wounds, she muttered, "Tell Mitchell and Zane that I love them very much, and tell Mitchell to take care of our Zane." Mitchell was Shannon's husband, and Zane was their 2-year-old little boy. Nearby, 11-year-old Cara Tate watched on in horror as her best friend, Paige Ann Herring, fell to the floor. As crimson blood pulled around her, Cara launched herself to the floor and wrapped herself around her best friend. She begged Paige to wake up, but Paige was motionless as the puddle of blood increased with each second that passed. Over at the gym, the scene was one of absolute bedlam. Children were terrified. Some of them had been shot, and some of them had been grazed by bullets. Some of them had even seen their best friends die before their very eyes. Some had tried to run back into the school building, but the doors had been locked because of the fire drill. They found themselves outside, in the line of fire. On a roof nearby, construction workers had witnessed the entire shooting. As the children in the schoolyard ran for cover, the construction workers not only called police, but they looked towards the source of the shooting. Around 200 yards away from the school, they were able to see two boys in the woods, shooting indiscriminately at their classmates. Police arrived at the scene in less than 5 minutes, and construction workers pointed them in the direction of the two shooters. Police entered the woods with their guns drawn, unsure of what they were going to find. As they entered a clearing, they found two boys who were taking off on foot. They were both dressed in camouflage shirts, pants, and hats. They were carrying handguns and rifles, including a Ruger 44 caliber rifle and a 30.6 hunting rifle. The officers quickly gave chase. Their weapons were raised and they ordered the boys to stop and drop their weapons. One complied, but one refused, raising his weapon in the direction of one of the officers. He held it there for just a brief second before throwing it to the ground and surrendering. The officers were immediately taken back by just how little the boys were. As their weapons were secured and they were detained, police approached a white van that the boys had been running towards. It was parked around half a mile away from the school. Inside, they found more guns and a plethora of ammunition. The two boys were identified as schoolmates, 13-year-old Mitchell Johnson and 11-year-old Andrew Golden. Back at the schoolyard, there was blood and bodies everywhere. Even more horrific, they were mostly bodies of children. Police and paramedics arrived on scene as they attempted life-saving measures on the children. Paramedic Charles Jones recollected, "We had children lying everywhere. They had all been shot. Roads leading to the school were quickly jammed by frantic parents, as details of the shooting began to emerge." Five people lost their lives that afternoon, while 11 others, including 10 students and one teacher, were wounded in the massacre. In total, Johnson and Golden had fired 27 rounds. In their van, they had around 500 rounds of ammunition, more than enough to kill everybody at the school. Whitney, although she was shot in the back, survived, but not without traumatic memories, not only of being shot, but of seeing her best friend call out for help before dying. That night at the hospital, Whitney woke up to the sound of screaming echoing in her ear. The victims were identified as 12-year-old Natalie Brooks, 12-year-old Paige Ann Herring, 12-year-old Stephanie Johnson, 11-year-old Brittany Varger, and 32-year-old Shannon Wright. Shannon had survived the initial shooting after being shot in the chest and abdomen. She had been transported to hospital, where she underwent surgery, but she died shortly thereafter. Shannon Wright was the mother of a 2.5-year-old son and was pregnant with her second child. Compassion came as a first nature to Shannon. She had always dreamed of becoming a teacher. While growing up, she would write out lesson plans for her younger brother and set him homework. Her ambitions came true in 1991, when she began teaching in the school district. Shannon really loved her job and the students she taught, even the troublemakers who she could always win over. As her husband Mitchell recollected, she never came home and talked bad about any of her kids. She just always enjoyed working with the kids and helping the kids. For those who knew Shannon, they weren't surprised that she had died attempting to protect one of her students. As the hail of bullets fell all around them, Shannon had stepped in front of a sixth grade student, saving her life in exchange for her own. Natalie had been looking forward to trying out for the cheerleading team, and she had recently just competed at a local beauty contest. Her friend Diane Hattenhaar recollected, "She was such a sweet girl. She always had a smile on her face." Natalie was a very artistic child as well. She loved music, singing, poetry, and even astronomy. Natalie was also a regular at the local church, and she brought her Bible to school each morning. Paige was known for her exuberant personality and her skills on the basketball, volleyball, and softball fields. She had just turned 12 years old 2 weeks earlier, and she spent much of her free time listening to music. Paige had ambitions of one day becoming an elementary school music teacher. Brittany was a dedicated student and an independent spirit. She was close friends with Natalie, and the two girls liked to play softball together. Her friends all said that she had an infectious smile and a bubbly personality. She was the joker of the family, often pulling tricks on her loved ones. As for Stephanie, her friend said that she was shy, but she was always nice to everybody. She never had a bad word to say, her friends all said. At school, she loved singing in the choir, and she excelled in maths. She was a little more than a month away from turning 13 years old, and she'd been talking recently about getting a summer job and volunteering at a local animal shelter. As Stephanie died on the schoolyard, a construction worker held her hand. He stroked her hair as she took her final breaths. When Johnson and Golden were identified in the media as the shooters, questions were raised regarding how they had access to so many weapons and what had motivated them to target their school. In Arkansas, there was no law that prohibited minors from possessing shotguns and rifles, but those younger than 21 were barred from having handguns. Golden was born on the 25th of May 1986 to parents Dennis and Pat Golden. They both worked as postmasters. Dennis was the leader of a local gun club, the Jonesboro Practical Pistol Shooters. Dennis was also a keen hunter. When Golden was born, he was ecstatic to have a son he could pass his interest on to. When Golden was just a child, his father would take him out shooting. In later years, he began training his son in practical shooting, which is a handgun competition with targets that move and pop up. Golden was certainly a good shot. Over the summer, He had shot his first duck, and he was anticipating that his next shot would be a deer. This wasn't unheard of in southern states, where children are often taught to hunt while young, and then carry the tradition down to their own children. Westside Middle School even closes down for the deer hunting season. In a way, it's a rite of passage in such states to own guns and go hunting. While hunting is a common pastime for many, a lot of people who knew Golden thought that his behaviour was peculiar. He had taken to wearing camouflage almost daily, and one neighbour, Lloyd Brooks, said that he had even told his daughter not to play with Golden. He commented, "I wouldn't let her play with his kid, because, it's mean to say, he was so demented, he was always threatening people." As for Johnson, he'd once been a God-fearing boy that enjoyed singing in the church choir. He'd grown up in Minnesota with his parents, but after they divorced in 1994, he and his mother, Gretchen, moved to Bono, which was around 9 miles from Jonesboro. Here, his mother married a man named Terry Woodard. Terry worked for Jack Brand Trucking of Bono, which provided the family with a mobile home on the property of the company. While Terry treated Johnson like his own son, the divorce had been really hard on him, and he often lamented that he missed his father, Scott Johnson, and wanted to be with him in Minnesota, where he spent his summers. By all accounts, Johnson had been a polite and well-rounded boy, but in 1997 his demeanour began to change. He started talking about gangs, bragging to his classmates that he was in the Bloods, and wearing the colour red, a symbol of his affiliation. Johnson also stopped attending church, and in class, he would point his finger towards his classmates and state, "Bang, bang." In class, he mocked his peers and he just generally became a mean-spirited boy. There was trouble before this as well. When Johnson had been staying with his father in Minnesota in the summer, his brother had walked into a bedroom and found him with a toddler with his trousers down. Police were contacted, and Johnson claimed that it was all a misunderstanding, that he had been trying to help the toddler pull up her pants after using the bathroom. The little girl was the daughter of Johnson's father's girlfriend. Johnson was charged with inappropriately touching the girl, and he was pending trial at the time of the shooting. As Johnson's behaviour was changing wildly, so was Golden's. In class, he took to throwing up hand signs and telling people that they were gang code. One afternoon towards the end of 1997, Golden told a friend that he was going to come into school and shoot people. This friend told his father, Edward Woodard, who in turn told a school counsellor. The school counsellor sat down with Golden and chatted about it. According to Golden, he had a dream about killing people in school, but then in this dream he himself had died, and the dream had scared him off the plan. The reality was much a worse nightmare. Golden and Johnson had become friends on the school bus that ferried them to and from Westside Middle School. The day before the shooting, Johnson was noticeably angry in school. He was upset about a recent breakup with his classmate, Candace Porter. The relationship was the kind of puppy love you expect as a preteen. Johnson and Candace would go to each other's houses and watch television and play in the schoolyard together. Johnson had told Candace she was pretty, and she said he seemed nice, so she agreed he could be her boyfriend. But this puppy love only lasted for 3 days. Candace quickly became disenchanted with her first boyfriend. She had told friends that she didn't want to date a boy who liked gangs and spoke of violence, so she quickly told Johnson that he was no longer her boyfriend. Johnson had taken the news bad, and he hurled insults and threats at Candace, telling her that he would kill her and kill anybody who got in the way. Something similar had happened around 2 years earlier, when Johnson was living in Minnesota. He had a girlfriend here as well, and when she broke up with him, he threatened violence, but not aimed at other people, it was aimed at himself. He said that he was going to hang himself, or shoot himself, before eventually calming down and abandoning the notion. Throughout the school day before the shooting, Johnson made various threats to other students. He told them that tomorrow they were going to find out if they lived or died. 12-year-old Charles Van Oven recollected. He told me yesterday that all the people who broke up with him, you know, he's going to come to school tomorrow and shoot them. Amber McBroon had heard Johnson threaten to kill everybody at the school. Today's sponsor on Morbidology is BetterHelp. Did you know that stress shows up in all kinds of ways? For example, headaches, teeth grinding, digestive issues, sleep problems, and even doom scrolling. Well, BetterHelp is here for you. I know for me personally, sometimes it's better to chat with somebody about my problems, such as sleep issues that leave me feeling tired, stressed out, and unable to focus. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anybody if you don't want to. BetterHelp is much more affordable than in-person therapy. Give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Morbidology listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/morbidology. That's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Johnson had said various violence-related things in the past and had been bragging about being involved in a gang. The students who heard his threats that morning, well, they just assumed that he was joking around, trying to look tough like he had done so before. In addition to those threats, however, Charles witnessed Johnson pull out a knife on another student. He considered telling the teacher, but then he opted out of it because he felt too scared. Before classes finished for that day, Johnson had hurled a direct threat at Candace. He told her, "I'm going to kill you." Candace thought that it was just another one of Johnson's outbursts. She left school that afternoon and played outside on her bicycle, not giving a second thought to what Johnson had said. Johnson wasn't the only one to mutter threats in school. Erica Swindle recollected how she had heard Golden say on occasion, "Man, he's making me so mad, I should just take out my gun and start blasting him in the butt for it." He'd always been a distraction in class, and recently had told Brittany Varner that he hated her because she wouldn't let him glance at her paper while the class was taking a test. Candace had been shot in the side during the massacre, but she survived when the bullet was deflected by her rib bone. Brittany wasn't so lucky. She had been shot dead. The two boys had meticulously planned the shooting, as described by Johnson.
"We first started discussing it and probably around Christmas time in 97. There was no given reason why. But we had discussed how it would happen, where we get the weapons at. Mr. Garnett asked me if I could help him with it because he needed somebody to drive for him. Apparently I knew how to drive. And at first I told him, yes, I would, I'd help him. And then I changed my mind because I thought, you know, I knew that I figured something bad could happen. And then we continued talking about it for a while. And it went on like that till I finally decided that I'd help him do the crime. And we had discussed where we get the guns, how we get them. And how I get the transportation and everything. And the week on spring break, right before spring break, we had decided that it's probably going to happen. And then Monday, we confirmed that it was going to happen. We talked to each other and said it was going to happen. And I decided how I was going to get the transportation. I had told a couple people about it. I had told, not about it, I had warned them that please don't come to school because I didn't. It, in case there was a chance of somebody getting hurt, I wouldn't want them to be one of them. And then Monday, went home after school. I took all my books out of my my bag, threw them in my bottom drawer. I had packed all my clothes and everything, sir. Had really a normal night, really. Stayed off to myself.
On the morning of the shooting, Johnson had told his mother that he wasn't feeling too well. He said that he had missed the school bus, but that his stepfather, Terry Woodard, would drive him to school. Instead, however, Johnson got out of bed, got ready for the day ahead, and then put the plan into motion. He stole the keys to his stepfather's van and stocked it up with potato chips, camouflage clothing and netting, a crossbow, a toolbox filled with food, hiking boots, knives, a machete, a tent and a sleeping bag, a knife and a propane torch. All of the things one would expect for a hunting trip out in the wilderness. But the boys weren't going to be hunting deer.
After the bus left, I followed the bus out. I went to the church on Golden's Road. I had stopped, walked down the street, saw Golden. He'd asked me where the van was, and I told him I parked it by the church, so if my little brother saw it, because the bus route went past his house, and I said if my little brother wouldn't see it and start questioning and ask what's happening. And he had asked me to go get the van for him, so I went back there and got the van. I parked it, and we had went in. He told me that he needed to throw his clothes and stuff in the van, so I opened the door for him. He threw his clothes in the van, and we decided that we were going to get the guns from Mrs. Golden's gun cabinet, our gun safe. And I tried getting in the gun safe, sir, and it didn't happen. It didn't work. And so we decided that Golden said his grandfather had some guns that we could possibly use. And I said, okay. And so we got back in the van.
Johnson made his way to Golden's home. He was armed with a hammer and a torch. Once Golden's parents left for work, Golden let Mitchell into the home, and they set their sights on a safe, where Dennis kept his high-powered rifles. The two boys hammered at the safe, but it couldn't be penetrated. Not dismayed in their search, they found three handguns that weren't locked up. From here, Golden and Johnson drove to Golden's grandfather, Douglas Golden's house. Golden knew the house well. He spent a lot of time with his grandparents since his parents often worked long hours at the post office. Golden knew his grandfather's routine like the back of his hand, and he knew that he was going to be at work that morning. Golden also knew where his grandfather kept his weapons. They pulled up outside and slowly approached the house, just to make sure that it was empty.
Finally, we got to his grandfather's house, sir, and we had jumped over the fence, and he said we're going to go in the back way, that way nobody will see us. Okay, and the back door is locked. And Golden had went and grabbed a crowbar and broke the window out. I reached in there, unlocked the door, and we had went through like that.
Once the coast was clear, they smashed a window in the basement, reached through and released the lock, and slipped inside. Inside the safety of the home, the two boys quickly rounded up all of the weapons they could find, including three high-powered rifles, four pistols and ammunition. Some of the weapons were kept in an unlocked gun cabinet, while the rest were underneath the mattress. Douglas worked for the Arkansas Game and Fish Department, and much like the rest of the family, he too was an avid hunter, hence the plethora of weapons. Over at the school, the first bell rang at 8:10 a.m. 10 minutes later, the second bell rang, and the students all gathered for the Pledge of Allegiance. Golden and Johnson were both marked down as absent. Meanwhile, once the van was loaded up with the arsenal, Golden and Johnson clambered back in and drove in the direction of the school. The van was running low on gas, so they stopped at two gas stations, where they were turned away due to their young ages. They stopped at a third gas station and were permitted to fill up. They continued in the direction of the school. The two boys pulled up a side road near the woods that bordered the school. Here, Johnson set up a vantage point. Golden entered the school and pulled the fire alarm. He then sprinted over to the woods where Johnson was positioned. He too got in position, and as their classmates began streaming out into the schoolyard, they opened fire. At first, it was only a couple of popping sounds, but the shooting swiftly became faster and steadier. As James Ray and Derek Trotter, two construction workers nearby, commented, "He had that struggler down and was mowing down everything in sight." Golden and Johnson knew that by pulling the fire alarm, all of the students would be gathered in the same place, with the school doors locked. Once the students were outside, they would be directly in the line of fire. Golden and Johnson didn't select their victims at random. Using the scope of their rifles, the two boys targeted girls. Only one boy was shot, 13-year-old Tristan McGowan, who was shot twice in the arm. As if the details of the shooting weren't horrific enough, the fact that the two boys were targeting girls only made the case that more wrenching. It made the motivation all too clear. Johnson was the ringleader, and he was furious that he had been broken up with. Johnson and Golden were arrested at the scene. Under state law, children under the age of 14 are charged in juvenile court. They can be held there until turning 21 years old, but they are typically turned out of the system by the time they turn 18 years old, simply because of a lack of facilities. After they were arrested, Prosecutor Brent Davis said that his office were going to charge them with 5 counts of capital murder in juvenile court. Over in Little Rock, U.S. Attorney Paul Casey announced that her office was looking into whether they could charge Johnson, who was 13 years old, with federal firearms violations, but it was likely that Golden would be off limits due to his young age. As the community tried to make sense of the massacre, Governor Mike Huckabee announced that he was going to create a task force to rewrite the state's juvenile justice code. He stopped short of calling for lawmakers to lower the age at which children can be tried as adults. He said, "The parent side of me says yes, I would do it in a minute, but there is a governor side of me that has to look at this long term and ask, do we want to put a 10-year-old child in prison for life or put him to death?" The school shooting was the 3rd fatal shooting at a school in the United States in the past 5 months, and many within the community strongly felt that something needed to be done to combat the violence. Governor Huckabee suggested that change needed to begin at home, as he echoed the recurring theme of family values, suggesting that the state needed to build better kids. Back in 1994, the Arkansas legislature had revamped juvenile crime laws. They expanded the list of major crimes for which adolescents 14 years or older could be tried as adults to 16 years old or older. In 1997, there was an attempt during a session to lower the age limit to 12 years old, but this failed. In announcing the tragic shooting to the community, Sheriff Dale Haas stated, "I've been in this for a long time. This is the worst thing I've ever seen."
There is a lot of questions about how could those two young men have done this. There's a lot of looking for answers. And what I'm telling them is that we're probably never going to have those answers. And instead of spending a lot of time trying to figure out why, we have to recognize that it happened and how can we move forward and how can we help each and every child in that school to get better.
Within hours, a makeshift memorial appeared outside the school in the form of flowers and candles, while school psychologists were brought in to counsel the students. Jack Bowers, one of the psychologists, said that it would take months, if not years, for some of the students to overcome the trauma. Some of them most likely never would. To experience something so horrific at such a young age, it's unimaginable. Classes for the next 2 days were cancelled, but a counselling meeting was held that night. The boys' young ages were truly on display when they appeared in court the next day. Johnson broke into tears several times and the judge stopped the proceeding briefly so that he could go and hug his father, Scott. Golden, on the other hand, smiled at his parents and came across as relaxed. One court official suggested that Golden was so young that he couldn't comprehend what exactly was going on or understand the severity of what he had done. Gone were the camouflage clothing that the boys were wearing, and in their place were prison-issued orange jumpsuits. The two boys were charged with 5 counts of murder and 10 counts of battery, and the judge ordered the Johnson and Golden be held until a hearing on the 29th of April. After the court hearing, Johnson's father, Scob, spoke publicly for the first time. He said that the media portrayal of his son as a monster was incorrect, and said that he was remorseful about what had happened. He stated, "I don't have an explanation for any of this. Nobody does. It's not something you would expect out of your child or anybody else's child." Johnson's grandfather, Douglas, also made some comments in the media. He said that his grandson had confessed to pulling the fire alarm and shooting at a car, but said that he blacked out and couldn't actually remember shooting anybody. He said that despite what his grandson had done, he still believed that children had the right to bear arms, as long as they receive proper firearm safety instruction. He stated, "All I can tell people is talk to your children. We talked to them, but something didn't work. Somebody failed somewhere." From court, the boys were transported to the juvenile detention center, where they were kept in separate cells, and secluded from one another and all other inmates. Johnson requested a Bible and a minister, while Golden cried and said that he wanted to go home. When lunch was served, cornbread, white beans and chicken, the boys asked if they could swap it for pizza. They were told no. 2 days after the shooting, classes resumed at Westside Middle School. Most students were driven to school by their parents, and sheriff's deputies were posted at the entrance. Students shuffled past the gymnasium, where evidence of the tragedy was in the form of blood stained into the ground nearby. Some of the students chatted with the media as they arrived. 12-year-old Colby Brooks said, "I'm a little bit nervous and scared, but I know the teachers did a good job of protecting us the other day. We're trying to get the fear out of our system." Some students chatted with AP News.
"My first period was Shannon Wright, and that didn't help at all. She wasn't there, and of course, and all the teachers were around, and we just all talking and just talking about how we felt and everything."
School officials and crisis counselors said that classes were resumed because they wanted students to return to their normal routine as quickly as possible. Parents were allowed to stay with their children for as long as they wanted, and grief counselors were available the entire day. A flowered cross hung on the flagpole on the grounds, and the flag was flown at half staff. A couple of days later, the whole town would be united in grief for the funerals of the victims. Paige was laid to rest first. Around 500 people packed into the chapel at the Farmers Union Funeral Home. Many who attended were classmates of Paige, and they all wore the school's red and white jackets. The service was led by Reverend Gary Cremins, who said that healing could not begin until forgiveness. Paige's casket sat at the front of the church, surrounded by pink and white flowers. Nearby, there was a photograph of Paige in her basketball uniform. The funeral for Natalie came next at Emerson Funeral Home. Natalie was supposed to be baptized that Sunday. Instead, she would be 6 foot under the ground. During the service, the song "My Heart Will Go On" by Celine Dion emanated from the speakers. Most in attendance wore white ribbons, which stood as a symbol of the tragedy. Natalie's casket was draped in pink and white roses, as Reverend Larry Ward said. "We know Natalie is flying around in heaven, kicking her heels up in a new place. Maybe God needed her up there to cheer him up." The following day, the final 3 victims, Shannon, Stephanie, and Brittany, were laid to rest. During Shannon's funeral, she was hailed as a hero for putting herself in the path of a bullet to save one of her students. Reverend Benny Baker urged the group to use Shannon as an example, telling them, "Do your job. Be the teacher you are to be. There is going to be pain and there is going to be struggle." Stephanie's funeral was led by Reverend Alvin Swan, who told her mother, Tina McGuire, "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. God gave you Stephanie. You had 12 wonderful years." Stephanie's open casket sat at the front of Emerson Funeral Home. The day before the funeral, Tina came to the funeral home to curl her daughter's hair and paint her nails pink for one final time. After the service, she stroked her daughter's brown hair, and she kissed her on the cheek. She tucked a baby doll and a teddy bear into the casket, and said goodbye to her daughter. The third funeral that day was Brittany, at Revival Tabernacle Church. Reverend William Holt told the mourners, "I don't care how low you are. Give her 2 minutes of time and she would have lifted you back up." Reverend Holt really struggled to hold in his emotion when he said how much he would miss Brittany's hugs. She was a regular at the church with her family. Podcorn are revolutionising podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. I'm lucky enough that Podcorn have sponsored this episode of Morbidology. There was once a time when only the big popular podcasts received sponsorships, but with Podcorn, indie podcasts such as Morbidology are able to work with amazing brands. Podcorn truly takes the confusion and stress out of finding sponsorships for your podcast, or even for finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect and either earn money for their podcast or advertise their brand. All you need to do is sign up to Podcorn for free and begin browsing the marketplace. The marketplace is easy to use and even has a handy calendar. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. You can charge whatever you want so you aren't constrained by the industry standard. Podcorn is an amazing way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes and sign up to Podcorn today. The opinion over how Johnson and Golden should be punished was very much divided. Jonesboro is located right in the heart of the Bible Belt, and much of the focus on the funerals had been on forgiveness. Because of their young ages, they had been charged as juveniles, but the prosecution were exploring whether they could charge them as adults. Some agreed with this, while others didn't and felt as though Johnson and Golden should remain charged as juveniles and then be set free once they turn 18, in the hopes that by then, they are reformed and can re-enter society. A decision regarding that was made shortly thereafter, when the Justice Department announced that they were not going to be filing federal charges against Johnson and Golden. Another debate would be picked up, and that would be a debate over gun laws. In Arkansas at the time, juveniles who are convicted of murder can buy, carry, and use handguns immediately upon their release from state supervision at age 18. This is because they are considered juvenile delinquents as opposed to felons. Arkansas lawmakers would call for a change in the state's gun laws, with Senator Jean Roebuck stating, "As far as I'm concerned, when you murder 5 people, you forfeited your right to guns forever." After the weekend of funerals, attention shifted once more to the motivation behind the murders. The families of Johnson and Golden had essentially turned on one another, pointing the finger at the other boy for being the driving force behind the massacre. Gretchen, Johnson's mother, said that it was planned by Golden. She said, "Mitch told me he never intended to hurt anybody, and he didn't take specific aim. He just meant to scare them, I guess. But then something went terribly wrong." It was quite an ironic statement, considering how many people had been shot, and considering the fact that Johnson had threatened to kill people just the day beforehand. She said that at home, guns were banned. But she didn't mention that the reason for this was because her husband, Terry, was a convicted drug dealer banned from having weapons. Terry and Gretchen had met while she was working as a prison guard, and he was serving a 5-year stint behind bars. Gretchen contended that just the day before the shooting, Golden had approached Johnson while on the bus and asked him to help carry out the massacre. Golden's grandfather, Douglas, on the other hand, said that Johnson had been the ringleader of the attack. Details had already emerged regarding Johnson's breakup and threats, but another potential motivation would surface. Defense attorney Tom Firth disclosed that when Johnson was 6 years old, he was molested by a relative of a daycare worker. According to defense Firth, the anger that Johnson felt from this could have led to the shootings. He stated to ABC News. You don't do something like what he is accused of doing because you break up with a girlfriend, or because you're angry at something that happened at school. There are reasons for it. During the news broadcast, Johnson's father, Scott, read aloud a letter that Johnson had written from the Juvenile Detention Centre. It read, Hi, my name is Mitchell. My thoughts and prayers are with those people who were killed or shot and their families. I'm really sad inside about everything. My thoughts and prayers are with those kids that I go to school with. I really want people to know the real Mitchell someday. A couple of days after the news segment aired, Scott changed the story regarding the alleged sexual abuse. While on the show, he and Defence Firth said that Johnson was molested by a relative of a daycare worker. He altered this and said that the abuse had not happened at the daycare centre, nor did it involve a daycare worker or one of their relatives. He reiterated that his son had been molested while growing up, but he refused to disclose any more information. The change of heart was quite bizarre, and understandably many people were left wondering if the sexual abuse had been fabricated as a defence in the case. Defence Firth was subsequently removed from the case for violating Johnson's attorney-client privilege. His interview with NBC News was an ethical breach, because he had disclosed comments that Johnson had said to him in private, and Johnson actually signed a statement saying he did not give Defence Firth permission to disclose statements he made. In July, President Clinton spoke at the White House. He said that recent school shootings had seared the heart of America, as he called on Congress and the state to tighten restrictions on children's access to guns. As he spoke, he was joined by Brittany's mother, Suzanne Wilson. Suzanne had some more comments. But to every gun owner in America, I want to say, please, please, for the sake of the children, lock up your guns. Don't let your children borrow the gun, or don't let them steal the gun. Be responsible. Don't let your gun become an instrument of murder. Don't let what happened in Jonesboro happen to your town. They were there to endorse a bipartisan Senate bill that was intended to encourage adults to store weapons and ammunition safely and separately. Under this new bill, adults would be held liable if a loaded gun or a gun stored with ammunition was taken by a child and then used to harm or kill another person or that child. At the time, 15 states already had such measures enacted, and they were often referred to as child access prevention laws. Victims of the Westside Middle School shooting would testify before legislators in an attempt to strengthen gun laws and impose stricter punishments upon children who kill. Whitney, Brittany's best friend, spoke in poignant detail about how she saw Brittany on the ground, bleeding to death. She stated, I never thought Brittany would die so young. I want those boys to pay for what they did. There were some other proposals suggested, such as removing the age limit at which children can be charged as adults for capital murder, or allowing judges to impose both a juvenile and then an adult sentence. Blended sentences were something that Lynette Thetford argued for. Lynette was a teacher at Westside Middle School. She was shot and injured during the shooting while trying to shield her students. Mitchell Wright, Shannon's husband, also had a few words to say. He spoke about the loss of his wife and said that it was wrong that Johnson and Golden could be released when they're just 18 years old. His and Shannon's son, Zane, would only be 7 years old if they were released at that age. Mitchell had brought along a videotape chronicling his life with Shannon. The videotape ended with graphic news footage of paramedics rushing his wife to the hospital, where she later died. While most people welcomed the Senate bill, the National Rifle Association was staunchly against it. They said it would be unsound to prescribe a single federal gun storage standard. The NRA's executive vice president, Wayne LaPierre, said, It's a one-size-fits-all federal mandate. It's inappropriate. It's heavy-handed. After the impactful testimony from the victims of the shooting, Representative Bobby Lee Trammell was so moved that he immediately announced, We're going to pass something. What that something is, I don't know yet. Typically in cases involving juveniles, court matters are closed. But it would be decided by Judge Ralph Wilson Jr. that court matters were going to be open. It would be up to him to determine whether Johnson and Golden were guilty, after the evidence was presented during trial. On the 11th of August, the trial for Johnson and Golden began. It was also Johnson's 14th birthday. There was a media blitz outside the courtroom as reporters scrambled to get a seat. Emotions ran high as the courtroom was packed with survivors and the loved ones of the victims. The trial wasn't a regular one either, since it was a juvenile court case. At around 10 a.m, the courtroom fell eerily silent as Johnson and Golden entered. It was the first time that Johnson and Golden had been seen since the brief court hearing shortly after the massacre. Johnson's case was called first. He was asked if he understood the charges against him. He replied that he did. He was then asked how he wanted to plea. Johnson replied, guilty. The judge then asked his parents if they agreed with his plea. Only his mother, Gretchen, said yes. His father, Scott, replied, he is making it on the advice of his mother and counsel. Golden's defense attorney, Val Prince, entered a plea of not guilty on his behalf. He said that Golden had been suffering from a mental defect and was unable to comprehend the proceedings. The not guilty plea from Golden meant that the prosecution would be presenting their evidence. For the first time, the details of the shooting were made public. Evidence indicated that Johnson had killed Shannon and Stephanie, while Golden had killed Natalie and Paige. It could not be determined who had killed Brittany. The court would hear impact statements from the victims' families and the survivors. Many lamented that a child-sized hole had been left in their hearts, a hole that would never be healed. Lloyd Brooks, whose daughter Jenna had been wounded, and his niece Natalie killed, asked, "What did she do to deserve being shot? How can you kill without any remorse?" He then said, "My hope is that they never return. No one should be set free automatically because of age. The next time they kill, it could be one of your family members." Tina, Stephanie's mother, detailed seeing her daughter's body in the funeral home. She had a 3-inch hole in her chest, where a bullet had pierced her back and come out the front of her heart. She said, "The pain was so great that I almost stopped breathing. As you know, she was one of the first ones gunned down. A big part of me died on this day also." Mitchell, Shannon's husband, stared directly at Johnson and Golden and said, "I lost my wife. I lost my best friend. Thanks to you two." He said that they had robbed their son of his innocence and said that if the tables were turned, that if somebody else was shooting into the schoolyard, Shannon would have jumped in front of a bullet for both Johnson and Golden. Judge Ralph Wilson found Mitchell Johnson and Andrew Golden guilty on 5 counts of capital murder and 10 counts of first-degree battery. He then asked if they had any comments to make. Johnson stood up, grasping tightly to a piece of paper. He said that he and Golden had never actually intended on killing anybody. He said that they planned on shooting over their heads to scare them, and contended that they were not targeting anybody in particular. He asked for forgiveness from the families of the victims, and from those who were wounded. Johnson's statement read in part, "I have sat in this jail for the past 4 months. I have had the opportunity to think about this. I'm sorry. I understand it may be impossible for some of you to forgive us. I thought we would shoot over their heads. We were not going to shoot at anyone in particular. I hope anyone who listens to these words knows how truly sorry I am. I pray to God he will heal all of their pain." Many of the family members scoffed at the apology. The weapons that the boys had used had scopes. They were aiming directly at the victims, not above their heads. Golden refused to make a statement. Johnson and Golden were sentenced to the maximum penalty allowed by law, confinement in a juvenile center until they turned 18 years old, and then perhaps until they turned 21 years old. Governor Mike Huckabee had taken offense to this and had earlier said that he would convert an existing facility or build a new one to keep them incarcerated until they are 21 years old. They were transferred to the Department of Human Services Alexander Unit, and shortly after they arrived, the state of Arkansas acquired a juvenile lockup in Dermot, which could hold them until they turned 21. In the aftermath of the murders, a civil lawsuit was filed by the victims and their families against the families of Johnson and Golden. In the lawsuit, they accused Dennis and Pat Golden of being liable for the actions of their son and accused Douglas of being liable for Johnson because the boys had stolen his guns. The lawsuit was seeking restitution for the deaths and also named two gun manufacturers that made the weapons used in the shooting. Another lawsuit was filed seeking damages from Johnson and Golden. Douglas and the gun manufacturers would subsequently be dismissed as defendants. Then another civil lawsuit was filed against Johnson and Golden to prevent them from profiting from the murders. The lawsuit would lead to years of legal wrangling, during which Johnson and Golden turned on one another, each blaming the other for what had happened that day. While it had been determined that Johnson had shot and killed some of the victims, he once again claimed that he had only shot in the air. It wouldn't be until 2017 that the families of the victims were awarded $150 million. The tragic case thankfully sparked change, and in 2000, the Extended Juvenile Jurisdiction Act was passed into law, which means that juveniles convicted of certain crimes could be sent to a juvenile detention centre until they turn 18, and then be resentenced by a jury to adult prison. Unfortunately, however, the law was not retroactive, meaning that it didn't apply to Johnson and Golden. In 2005, Johnson was released from prison with a clean record. After turning 18, he was moved to the Federal Correctional Institution, where he remained until his 21st birthday. In 2007, he was in trouble with the law once more when he was found to be carrying a loaded gun and 21 grams of marijuana. When he was arrested, he was with Justin Trammell, who had been convicted as a juvenile of killing his father with a crossbow. Johnson had been living with Trammell since his release in 2005. Johnson was convicted and sentenced to 4 years. But while awaiting sentencing, he was arrested after stealing a credit card from a disabled man in the convenience store where he worked. He was sentenced to 12 years, but was then sentenced to an additional 4 years for a charge of theft by receiving and financial identity fraud. Johnson was released from prison in 2015. By this point, Golden had been released from custody as well, after turning 21 years old. He was released back in 2005, on his 21st birthday. His freedom wasn't to last, however. Golden had changed his name following his release and moved to Jackson in Missouri. In July of 2019, the car he was driving crashed head-on into another vehicle on Highway 167. Johnson was pronounced dead at the scene, and so was Daniel Petty, the driver of the other vehicle. Mitchell Johnson currently stands as the only living mass shooter who is not behind bars. Schools should be a place of safety and sanctuary, but in a matter of just seconds it became a place of death and destruction, as a wall of bullets hailed from two boys who had taken up a vantage point in nearby woodland. The Westside Middle School shooting stirred massive debate over Americans' gun culture and children's access to guns. But still, not much has changed. The Westside Middle School shooting wasn't the first, and it certainly won't be the last. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd also like to say a big, massive thank you to my lovely new Patreon supporter, Thea. If you want more episodes of Morbidology, you can join me on Patreon, where I have bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus each month. There's also ad-free and early release episodes, bonus content, and most importantly, my undying love. If you didn't know, I'm going to be at CrimeCon in Glasgow on the 10th of September this year. It's just a one-day event, and I'll be on Podcast Row all day. I have a 10% discount code if any of you are able to make it. Just head on over to crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code MORBID for 10% off your ticket. I hope to see some of you there. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Stop the Killing. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
I'm Sarah Ferris, true crime podcaster.
And I'm Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
And we have a, well, not so gently named podcast called Stop the Killing. Yeah, there's a clue in the title. We need your help to end the global mass shooting epidemic. Find out how as we bring you the stories right from the source.
If you would have told me that a Columbine could happen at Columbine, I would have said no way.
I remember just thinking, he's got a gun. Something rose up inside, and I said, not my school.
What we can't underestimate is the power that individuals could have in stopping these school shootings.
My little boy, Alex, was murdered. If we can fix the failures, we can save lives.
My daughter, Elena, was killed. She'd want me to do something about this. I know she would do something about it.
Join us and be part of the solution. Subscribe now to Stop the Killing podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your true crime podcasts.